It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Today is Holy Thursday, or Maundy Thursday, the day many Christians mark Jesus' Last Supper. 2,000 years later, there's a fight over the site where the Last Supper is said to have taken place. Israel controls the building, but the Vatican says it is the actual owner. Israel and the Vatican have been trying to resolve the dispute for over two decades, and as Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem, it looks like they are about to reach an agreement.
If there's one building in Jerusalem that represents the tangle of religions in this city, this is it. The ground floor is a Jewish holy site, said to house the tomb of the biblical King David. The second floor is a Christian holy site, the room believed to be the site of Jesus' Last Supper. And on the roof, there's an old minaret from when this place was marked a Muslim holy site. One building, three religions, decades of property disputes, and the fight isn't over.
So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through the door here and have a look at this room of the Last Supper. So let's go in.
Shimon Gibson is an archaeologist from London who has excavated sites connected to Jesus' final week. He believes the Last Supper and the burial of King David happened in other parts of the city. Still, Jews, Christians, and Muslims venerate this site.
Look at the architecture. You have these ribbed vaults.
The building was destroyed and rebuilt a few times over. The original Byzantine church was replaced by the Crusaders.
You can see pilgrims have left their names on the walls.
Later, it was taken over by Muslim Mamluks.
Over here, you can see a mihrab, indicating that at one point this chapel was a mosque.
Catholic Franciscan friars took custody in the 14th century. 200 years later, they were kicked out by the Ottoman Sultan. After the 1967 Mideast War, Israel took control. Israeli authorities have wanted to avoid allowing the Vatican to administer any kind of authority over a site that today isn't under Vatican control. So Israel limits organized Christian prayers here to just a few times a year. There are no crosses on the wall. Groups of pilgrims from around the world shuffle in, take snapshots, and shuffle out. Sometimes stray cats wander around. Katarina Iacono from Germany sat on a bench in the corner.
I'm a little bit disappointed because, yes, I was expecting a place where you can go, where you can pray, and I think it's difficult because it's very loud, and with cats and with some smells, it's not very easy.
The Vatican says this building belongs to the church, since friars bought it hundreds of years ago. Father David Neuhaus is a Catholic vicar in Jerusalem.
The place is so essential, so much an integral part of the Christian narrative, that that's needless to say a dream that we would one day be able to pray there in a regular fashion, like in the other holy places.
It's not the first time in history that Christian prayer here has been limited. In the 16th century, the Ottoman Sultan prohibited Christians from the room of the Last Supper. David's tomb is the main attraction today for devout Jews like this one, praying near the large stone tomb marker. Rabbi Avram Goldstein directs a seminary at the site. He says he's pleaded with Israeli politicians not to cede any control here.
The minute they'll make it as a church, Jews, halachically according to the Jewish law, are forbidden for them to go in there. I think it'll be a disgrace for Israel. You know, it's like milk that'll be spilled and you never can return it back.
For two decades, Israel and the Holy See have been trying to work out disputes over church properties in Jerusalem. One of the few remaining thorns is the Last Supper room. Shmuel ben Shmuel, an Israeli negotiator, says the talks are at a critical moment.
We don't want to go into all the details right now when we are in the midst of negotiations.
A final agreement could come as early as June. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
At this week's Passover Seders, Jews around the world lay out ceremonial meals. There's parsley or radishes to represent spring rebirth and horseradish to show the bitterness of slavery. According to some Orthodox rabbis, these fresh vegetables, especially if they're organic, bring their own theological issues. Bugs. From Portland, Oregon, Dina Prichep reports.
At the People's Farmers Market in southeast Portland, a handful of stands sell local organic produce. It's too early for asparagus, but they've got kale, lettuce, radishes. And, as Orthodox Rabbi Tzvi Fisher shows me, a few other things.
So if you look right down there on the spinach, a little bug right there, and there's another one right there.
To be clear, Rabbi Fisher thinks these bugs, aphids, mites, and little green thrips, are totally natural. They're what you expect when you buy food that grows in the ground, especially without pesticides. But for some religious Jews, like him, they do pose a problem.
In Leviticus, in discussion of which animals are kosher and which shall not be eaten, it says sherets, which means basically the runny things, things that crawl around.
And it's not because they're unhealthy or unclean in a sanitary sense.
It's a spiritual concept.
There is some debate about the details, but basically, if you're keeping to this spiritual definition, you've got to get the bugs out. Kosher certification groups, like the one Rabbi Fisher works with, teach classes on how to spot tiny insects and how to wash them off. But not every Jew feels this same measure of obligation. Rabbi Joey Wolf heads Portland's Reconstructionist congregation.
Whenever you're involved in spiritual practice, you're saying to yourself, am I doing this because I'm trying to keep the rhythm? And if I break the rhythm, all hell literally could break loose. Or am I trying to do this because if I keep the rhythm in some way, it will connect me profoundly to the heartbeat of the universe?
For Wolf, religiously checking for bugs doesn't really qualify. It's kind of a non-issue. But he understands why people do it.
The fact that something is archaic does not necessarily mean that it doesn't have a pulse. I'll give you an example. A great many religious Jews put on tefillin.
Little boxes with Torah scrolls that are strapped to your head and your arm while you pray.
Now that looks incredibly archaic, but when you're doing it, it's an absolutely spectacular ritual. So it's not by dint of things being peculiar that you should rule them out. It's just that at some point people are going to say, here's where I begin and here's where I end. And it's simple as that.
Different Jewish movements, conservative, reform, and reconstructionist, begin and end in different places on what it means to be observant. And for many Orthodox, like Rabbi Fisher, this issue matters.
I sent an email on a project that was due, but I left out the dot before .com in the email address. So when the issue is important, it doesn't make a difference if it's tiny and a dot, and in this case, small as a bug. If it's important, it's important. And it's a verse in the Torah, so to us, it's important.
And Fisher says it's especially important on Passover.
People didn't get lettuce and parsley very often in the shtetl back in Europe, where they could hardly afford a loaf of bread. So pre-Passover vegetable washing is something that has actually been a part of the Jewish community for many, many years.
While Rabbi Fisher and Rabbi Wolf may disagree on some of the theological details, they'll both be sitting down to celebrate Passover with fresh vegetables on their tables on Friday night. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchup in Portland, Oregon.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for Faith Matters. At this time, just about every week, we dig into matters of faith and spirituality. And so today, we are going to spend some time talking about the important religious holidays being observed by many this weekend. Passover starts tonight, and we'll talk about why wine aficionados need no longer turn up their noses at kosher wines. That's later. But first, we are going to talk about Easter, observed this weekend in the Western calendar, next weekend in the Eastern Orthodox Church. The 40 days of Lent, Holy Week, and today, Good Friday, is a time of sacrifice and reflection. President Obama talked about sacrifice earlier this week at his Easter prayer breakfast.
The struggle to fathom that unfathomable sacrifice makes Easter all the more meaningful to all of us. It helps us to provide an eternal perspective to whatever temporal challenges we face.
We were thinking, though, that accepting that perspective might be hard, especially when those temporal challenges, as the president put it, can be so very difficult. Losing jobs, losing homes, just trying to stay afloat. Pastor Rudy Rasmus confronts these issues every day in his church, St. John's Downtown in Houston, Texas. So we thought this was a good time to catch up with him to talk about how he is encouraging his parishioners to maintain hope. Pastor Rudy, thanks so much for joining us once again. Happy Easter to you.
Hello, Michelle. Good to be here.
Now, your church has more than 8,000 members from all walks of life, and we've checked in with you previously about how people were weathering the recession. And so we wanted to ask you how you are encouraging people, particularly during the Lenten period, which is a period that emphasizes sacrifice, when many people probably already feel they're sacrificing, just maintaining.
This unique congregation that I'm a part of with 8,000 people, from every neighborhood in Houston. So 150 zip codes, every socioeconomic group, every demographic. And you bring a diverse group of people like that together, you see sacrifice from many different perspectives, as dire as the homeless men and women that we serve every day to people who are in their own right very wealthy. So we talk about the fact that it's not always about an equal gift, but an equal sacrifice. So to a person who is homeless and attempting to put together bus fare, you know, in essence, to give up maybe that one item that means the world could be a huge sacrifice for that person. I think the most extreme were some folk who gave up sex for this time. There are many folk who have sacrificed a meal. But what really happens when you make a sacrifice that's meaningful, it gives you a chance to reflect on what's really important. And in essence, we call it keeping the main thing the main thing.
We're speaking with Pastor Rudy Rasmus. He's senior pastor at St. John's Downtown in Houston, Texas. That's a church he co-pastors with his wife, Juanita. We're talking about how he's observing the Easter season. So now we've traveled through Lent. Today is Good Friday and such a crucial time in the Christian calendar. On to Easter Sunday. Have you thought about what your message will be?
Yeah, I've been reflecting on that. And in Judaism, you know, resurrections really meant a physical resurrection. In essence, the person coming back to life. And in our context, there are a lot of things that have died. For instance, our economy has been very challenged and people's financial lives have passed. You know, there are relationships that in many cases, as a result of the financial challenges, have come under just undue stress and the love has died. You know, what I'm going to encourage on Sunday is to believe in the fact that this hope means that whatever has died in our life of meaning and of value can be restored and it can come back better than ever.
What are you saying to people who just, I don't know if you have people in your congregation who you're kind of particularly worried about, who you feel might really be on the edge of despair?
We know, connecting the fact that this physical resurrection is more than just sort of a spiritual resurgence, but to imagine that a person's life was dead and now has come back fully. Hope is really the essence of this moment. And for the hopeless to imagine, if you can wrap your mind around a person coming back to life, then anything else that might be of challenge in your life has the possibility of coming back again. So when we think about folk who have lost homes, lost jobs, and haven't been able to find work, hope is a huge message. And I'm telling you, I am encouraging people to believe, you know, the power of belief and then the power of shared belief. When you get a few folk around you who also are believing that good can come out of a tragic situation, it is amazing how that kind of spreads into the spirit of the person who might be undergoing just some insurmountable challenges. So really, hope and the possibility of restoration is really what it's about for me.
Is there anything in particular this Easter Sunday that's giving you hope and that's inspiring you as you prepare to address your congregants this weekend?
You know, I'm just recently back from a trip to India, and there I encountered despair at an unprecedented scale. And while there, I had a chance to reflect on three things. One, you know, my hope at being a better husband, even a better devotee of Christ, and becoming even a better friend. You know, as I kind of think back on how quickly life goes and how precious life is, I'm really using this time hoping for a more effective life in the days ahead.
Rudy Rasmus is senior pastor at St. John's Downtown. That's a church in Houston, Texas that he co-pastors with his wife, Juanita. And he was kind enough to join us from member station KUHF in Houston, Texas. Pastor Rudy, thank you so much for speaking with us, and happy Easter to you and to yours.
Happy Easter to you too, Michelle, and thank you again.
We are going to continue our Faith Matters conversation now with a look at Passover. Tonight, Jewish families will get together for a special Seder dinner. That's the ceremonial meal that begins the holiday. They will retell the story of Moses, who freed the Israelites from bondage in Egypt. They'll eat matzah or unleavened bread, and they will drink 4 glasses of wine. And when it comes to kosher wine, there used to be, let's say, slim pickings. And they weren't generally known as taste sensations, but our next guests say that is no longer the case. The kosher wine world now offers hundreds of options from all over the world. Here to tell us more about that, Rabbi Shmuel Hirschfeld. He is the senior rabbi at Ohev Shalom, the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C. He joins us often to tell us more about the Jewish holidays and customs. And also with us, Yossi Horowitz. He is a lawyer by day and a wine aficionado by night. He's also a regular judge for Jewish Week's annual Kosher Wine Guide. And he writes a newsletter about kosher wine. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for joining us.
It's good to be here, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle, for having us.
So, Rabbi, could you just tell us, first of all, what is the role of wine in Passover, and why is it customary for Jews to drink 4 cups of wine during the Seder?
Passover is the night where we celebrate our redemption from Egypt many years ago, and one of the keys to making a Passover Seder meaningful and engaging everyone in the Passover Seder is to actually view ourselves as having been redeemed this night. And so tonight, as we sit at our Seder, we are going to be celebrating our freedom from bondage. And one of the ways our rabbis teach us that we celebrate is by drinking wine. It's a festive occasion. And so that's why we have 4 cups of wine at the Passover Seder. There are 2 explanations for 4. One is that it corresponds to 4 expressions of redemption when God speaks to Moses in the book of Exodus. And a second explanation is that at every ritual that we do, we try to have wine. And there are 4 major parts to the Passover Seder that we drink wine for.
Yossi, can you explain to us briefly what makes a wine kosher? And can any wine be kosher?
Sure, Michelle. In general, yes, any wine can be kosher. All that is required in a nutshell for a wine to be kosher is that it is handled from the time the grapes arrive at the winery until the time it goes into a bottle by Sabbath observant Jews, and that every ingredient in the wine is kosher. There are multitudes of rules and regulations that surround these 2 points. And the most important thing to note is that being kosher has nothing to do with the quality of the wine.
And I was going to ask you, why is it, and I'm not being mean here, but why is it that kosher wine has such a terrible reputation, or should I say had such a terrible reputation?
Well, I think it's a historical thing. As Rabbi Hirschfeld said, the kosher wine revolution or the resurgence of quality kosher wine has occurred over the last 30 years. The primary consumer of these wines is the kosher wine consumer. And I think in recent years, they have become more sophisticated in the area of culinary, gastronomic, and oenophilic delights. And I think with that increasing sophistication comes an increased demand for a better wine to put on the table. And while most people who are not kosher on a regular basis, who do not drink kosher wine on a regular basis, their memories of kosher wine come to Manischewitz, which is and can be cloyingly sweet, thick, and not exactly what you would serve with a fine meal.
I have fond memories of Manischewitz, but then again, I think a fine vintage is Sprite, so it shows you what I know. Tonight marks the first night of Passover, and we are talking about kosher wine. Our guests are kosher wine aficionado Yossi Horowitz. Also with us, Rabbi Shmuel Hirschfeld of the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C. We're going to actually sample a couple of bottles here, and these are both widely distributed in the U.S. To start, we have, I think, is a Sauvignon Blanc, right, mm-hmm. from Ella Valley Vineyards in Israel. And Rabbi, I understand, or maybe Yossi, this is a question for you. I understand that the rabbi has to open it in order for it to remain kosher. Is that, do I have this right?
So that
he has
correct.
To open it. Okay.
If a non-Jew were to open a bottle of wine, an observant Jew could no longer sample that wine. In order to get around that, there is a concept called mevushal, which means literally translated from Hebrew cooked, otherwise known as boiled. If the wine has been boiled, then any person can handle the wine without rendering it unkosher.
So, Rabbi, will you do the honors?
All right. First of all, Michelle,
Yossi, we need you.
In my home, my wife opens the bottle of wine.
Okay. And Rabbi is not giving up his day job for a career as a sommelier. I'll just mention that. So
I'm going to need help here. Can I stick this between my...
You can do whatever you need to do to open that.
That makes it
Yay,
easier.
Yay, there you are.
Now, Michelle, I'm going to need to recite a blessing before I drink
Please.
The wine.
Now I'm getting thirsty.
Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Borei Pri Hagafen.
Amen.
How is it?
It's a perfect wine.
Yeah, see, you recommended this one too, I think.
And I did.
What do you like about it?
Well, it actually comes from the Ella Valley Winery, like you said, which is in the Ella Valley in Israel, which has actually some great historical importance. It is the scene of the famous battle between David and Goliath. In more modern times, it is the scene of a incredible little winery that makes a number of really, really special wines. The wine in question that you guys are enjoying is a fresh, vibrant, fruity wine that has a nice bit of acid in it that helps it go well with food. It should be overtones of some citrus, grapefruit, things like that.
You getting all that, Rabbi?
Yes, he told me prior to the show that he only serves wine at the Seder that he would serve to the Messiah when he comes. So
well, that's good.
That's
to know.
A good rule.
That is a good rule. Let's move into red wine. The next bottle you selected for us is from California. It's a 2007 Special Reserve Cabernet Sauvignon. And Rabbi, will you do the honors again?
The second bottle you are sampling is actually a Mevushal bottle.
Okay.
So anyone can actually handle that.
Anyone can handle that one.
And the wine that you guys are enjoying and making me thirsty is from the Alexander Valley. It's a Cabernet Sauvignon, and they make it very well.
Rabbi, what do you think?
I like the white one.
You like the white? You're more of a, and in general, are you more of a red or a white?
It is a custom to drink red wine at the Passover Seder because the red reminds us that the first plague was done with blood. So there is a added practice. So at our Passover Seder, we only drink red wine. But just so happens to be, I like this white wine more than this red wine.
So finally, before we let you go, Rabbi, some people can't drink wine.
Right.
For whatever reason, they might be expecting, it might just not agree with them. They might have perhaps an issue where it is best that they not drink wine. Is there an option? What should they do?
Well, the first option is grape juice. If you can't drink wine, then you can drink grape juice, and you can fulfill your commandment and the ritual requirement to drink wine by drinking the grape juice, especially if you're a child or an alcoholic, etc. But if you can't drink wine and you can't drink grape juice, call me and we'll work it out. It's no problem.
All right. Just be sure you show up at the Seder. That's right. Rabbi Shmuel Hirschfeld leads Ohev Shalom, the National Synagogue here in Washington, D.C. He was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Yossi Horowitz is a lawyer by day and a wine aficionado by night. He joined us from member station WLRN in Miami, Florida, where he is observing the holidays with his family. Rabbi, thank you so much. Yossi, thank you so much for joining us. And what's the proper greeting? Is it Happy Passover? Gut Yontif?
Gut Yontif is perfect, Michelle.
Gut Yontif.
Thank you. Gut Yontif.